welcome to the Chagiga part of the Rabbi's Talmud class. Rabbi Bolton has taught Megillah, right?
Yeah, we've been Megillah.
He's been studying Megillah. And he was kind enough to invite me to come and teach while I am here, not only in this world, but in this part of the world. I'm delighted to have these three sessions in January in order to warm things up, a little bit of hot stuff, some study of mysticism, which those of you who were on board last year remember that we did the first part of the second chapter of the Tractate of Hagiga last year. And I want to continue on from a point which was at the very end of the last session that we did, which I did rather quickly, but I'd like to return to in order to look at in much greater detail, and go from there, as the Talmud goes, to look and focus carefully on what the Talmud has to say about Rabbi Elisha ben Abuya. Acher. He was understood by the Talmud to be a heretic, and the Talmud spends time discussing what it was that, number one, led to his heresy, and number two, what the nature of that heresy was. So it's a very interesting example. The model of Elisha ben Abuya as a heretic is a very appealing model in many ways. It was used most famously by Rabbi Milton Steinberg in his book As a Driven Leaf, which, if you are looking for some good theological fiction, Rabbi Steinberg's book, he was the the great rabbi of the Park Avenue Synagogue from 1930 until his death in 1952, if I remember correctly. And Steinberg wrote a number of books, but probably I think his greatest is on Elisha ben Abuya. But he picked it up in terms of post-World War II ideas about what religion could or should be. Focus in modern studies is, of course, on what the Talmud is really talking about. Frankly, you won't see that by reading, well, you'll see a little bit of it by reading the commentary of the Art Scroll, simply because the Art Scroll seems to be very dependent always on the classical Jewish sources. And the classical known Jewish sources don't necessarily tell you what something did mean in the second century. They will tell you what it meant to somebody who was in the 15th century, and when he read it, what it meant to him. But there's a big difference between the 15th, 16th centuries and the second century. One of the beauties of modern scholarship is that we now know a great deal about the second century. And we will bring that to bear and have some sense of the nature of heresy as it was conceived of in the ancient world. This is very important for a number of reasons, from a very practical historical perspective, because remember that one of the competing religious options in the second century became very popular. It was called Christianity. And that too became an alternative question about whether that was a heresy. I think even in order to understand the early nature of Christianity, it's very helpful to understand what were the conceptions of heresy in the first two centuries. Okay? Because these are things that the early Christian fathers had to articulate and had to deal with, because, in essence, they didn't want to be heretics. That was not their conception. They might have been from a Jewish perspective, but they didn't want to be from their perspective, and they therefore had to justify themselves as being the true Israel, as opposed to those who had waywardly rejected the Messiah who had come on the scene. So I think that there are a lot of ramifications to this material even before we look at it. First thing I want to do is simply to put it in context again, to review for you what we did in great detail last year, but to do it very quickly, and that is to remember what the Mishnah is on which this chapter, the second chapter of Chagiga, is based. That is the famous Mishnah of Ein Dorshin Ba'arayot Ela Bishlosha. Ein Dorshin, sorry, not Ela. Ein Dorshin Ba'arayot Bishlosha. Excuse me, one is not permitted to teach the subject of sex in a class of three. Again, I don't want to go into this in any detail, but just I'm reviewing. If you remember, the reason for that was because if you have a class of three and an issue comes up that the teacher has to address, that will normally come up with one student, which will leave the other two students without any guidance. And therefore, since the nature of the material is such, how can I say it, arousing material, it's potentially dangerous material. And one can learn, one can get involved in conversation with a peer, which is inappropriate to what the subject actually is. So therefore, you are not allowed to teach sex in a class of three, only two. Or the logic in two is, if a student asks the question, how many people are left over? One. He had nobody to talk to. And perforce, instead of talking to nobody, guess what? He'll listen to the teacher and the student who has asked the question. Not a bad situation. Okay, that's the first one. Ein dorshin ba'arayot bishlosha. Velo b'maaseh bereshit bishnayim. And not in Maaseh Bereshit, and that is the something like the theory of creation, with two students. Theory of creation can mean a lot of things, and we saw last year what the Gemara said. It has to do with the nature of speculation in the ancient world. It has to do with the nature of science in the ancient world. And a lot of that is what we today would call astrology. The science of the ancient world was, as I said just now, what we call astrology. With us, astrology has a pejorative sense to it. And you have to sort of overcome that if you're interested in it. The pejorative sense is that there's something wrong with it. There's something mythical about it that's non-scientific. In the ancient world, it was the science. That was the science that people had at their disposal. And, of course, it's a science that's not exactly like modern science. It is a somewhat objective science. It is a science that is based on traditions, on certain mythological traditions, and it was considered to be potentially dangerous. Frankly, when Maimonides reads this, Maimonides is reading it then in the 12th century, when he reads it, he understands the term Maaseh Bereshit to mean science. It is the study of all those things that can be studied by direct observation, which is the way we would define science also. Okay? And frankly, I don't have to argue the fact that for a great number of centuries, in fact, in certain places right down till today, science is seen in opposition to religion. That science says one thing, religion says the other thing, and the two really can't meet. As those of you who know me well know, I think that that's totally wrong, and that the only decent religion is one that both accepts the conclusions of science, but as well where science knows its limits. Limits to science, and scientists generally, or at least enlightened scientists, know those limits, are sensitive to those limits, and realize that there is a place for another way of thinking about certain things that are important in human existence. So the second one now was Ma'aseh Bereshit, specifically in the Mishnah, as understood in the time of the second century CE, and that nor may Ma'aseh Bereshit be studied with two people. It's essentially more dangerous, the nature of that material, and therefore it can only be studied by one person. The third of the possibilities here is Ma'aseh Merkava, the study of the chariot. And there last year we went into great detail that what is meant by that is, first of all, the imagery drawn from the book of Ezekiel, in the first chapter of Ezekiel, the vision of the divine, and that is a vision where the divine sits on top of a chariot, and is a very psychedelic kind of vision. But that is the most problematic of all of these three categories of sex and science. The most problematic, really, is that of Merkava, of the Merkava. It is what we would call probably mysticism. It is not what Maimonides understood to be mysticism. Maimonides, when he read this, again in the 12th century, saw it as metaphysics. He saw it in Aristotelian terms. So metaphysics, there is physics, which is the study of science, and there is metaphysics, which is above science. Okay? It is the science, as it were, of absolute things. Of absolute things. That's not what it meant in the second century. In the second century, it had to do with a certain kind of mysticism that was prevalent at that particular period of time. And in the literature, that is referred to as the Merkava mysticism. Merkava mysticism. It is mysticism that, on the one hand, uses the imagery of Ezekiel, but on the other hand, as with most mysticisms, it becomes its own area of study. The time of the rabbis, for example, there were sects of what were called Hechalot mystics. The Hechal is the inner part of the temple. The Hechal is the inner part of the temple. So that was used as a terminology that referred to this kind of mysticism. And I say mysticism always has its own form. It becomes its own study. It has its own principles. It has its own metaphors. And that was the case here as well. The way in which that's discussed in the Mishnah is as Ma'aseh Merkava. That is Ma'aseh Merkava. Now Ma'aseh Merkava, you are not allowed to study even with one. Even with one. And rather, it can't be a teacher-to-student relationship. It instead has to be a student who already knows enough to do it on his own. Okay? Now, that's potentially dangerous, to tell you the truth, because the student could be wrong. And if you remember, toward the end of our sessions last year, we read about students who began to spout Ma'aseh Merkava in front of their rabbis. And the rabbi said, wait a minute, you can't do this. And he said, but I know you can't do it, unless you can do it on your own and you know what you're talking about, and let me tell you what I'm doing. The rabbi then got off his donkey. Remember the beautiful way in which these stories were put. The rabbi got off his donkey, wrapped himself in his talit, and he began to pay attention to what the student was saying, and suddenly the heavens began to open, and all kinds of shining lights began to shine. And after it is all over, the rabbi says, for you the world was created. For you Indeed, our father Abraham is proud to be your father as my father. How great is this that we have done? Okay, sorry. And we contrasted that last year with the Mishnah itself. The Mishnah itself sets you up to think that you can't do this. And that, interestingly enough, in the Gemara gives us examples of people not only who do it, but who are praised for it. Okay? So there's a very interesting tension that we have between the Mishnah and the Gemara, something that is forbidden, but ends up being done and actually is a source of praise. Okay? Now, in the Talmud, in chapter 2, page 12b, page 14b, there comes a section which is perhaps the most famous section of the entire tractate, one of the most famous sections of the entire Talmud. And we went through it very quickly at the end of last January, and I didn't want to deal with this material without having you see it. But we really didn't go into any detail with it, and that's where I'd like to begin now. So, for those of you who don't have a text and who would like in the future to have a text, this is the Tractate of Hagiga. It's available as a one-tractate English-Hebrew in the Art Scroll. You can get it also online without having to buy it if you start on 14b. And just go for about two folios, 14, 15, 16. We won't get beyond that, I'm sure. So you can print it out and use that if you like. Or if you want to invest in a wonderful piece of literature by the Art Scroll. By the Art Scroll, it's terrific. Those of you who are following, it's in 14b2. On the bottom right side of the page. Any questions still here, by the way? Any questions so far? Okay. Tanu Rabbanan. The rabbis taught. Now, the Tanu Rabbanan is always a baraita. A baraita, you remember, means a piece of rabbinic literature that dates from the time of the Mishnah, which is to say, sometime before, either at the year or before the year 200 CE. Okay? The Mishnah is edited by Rabbi Judah the Prince in 200 CE. All right, that's of the Christian era. And a baraita is something that was kept outside of the Mishnah for whatever reason. Just Rabbi Judah didn't include it. But in the Gemara, in the commentaries on the Mishnah that date from at least the year 200, and somewhere, some of it goes to the year 500, but in that period of time, many of the traditions that date back 200 and before suddenly are brought into the discussion. And not in the Mishnah, they're outside of the Mishnah, therefore they're called Baraita. Baraita in Aramaic means outside. It's outside of the Mishnah. Okay? But again, it's very old material. It dates from the time of the Mishnah. Here is the baraita. Arba'a nichnasu bapardis. Four entered into pardes. Now, pardes is translated here in the English as the orchard. Four entered into the orchard. The Elohim, and these are they. Ben Azai, Uven Zoma. One of the people was named Ben Azai. It's interesting, he's not called Rabbi Ben Azai. Certainly not in the stories. Some places in the Talmud he does appear as Rabbi Ben Azai, but generally not. So Azai, Ben Azai, is the son of Azai. Uven Zoma, another person like that, okay? Not introduced as Rabbi so-and-so. He's the son of Zoma. We don't even have either of their first names. which is unusual. The rabbis are always introduced by their first name. Okay? Acher. Acher, which means the other one. The Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva. Now there you notice Rabbi Akiva is a normal name. You've heard of Rabbi Akiva, one of the great, most famous of the rabbis of the Talmud. But the odd one here is Acher. Acher. The other one. He is the heretic. And therefore he is not mentioned by name. Rather, he is simply referred to as the other one. There's only one other person so dealt with in the Talmud. He's called Oto Ha'ish, that man. In the general parlance, he's known as Jesus of Nazareth. So these are the two, but Jesus is mentioned rarely in the Talmud. Acher is mentioned far more often. And that is Rabbi Elisha ben Abuya. Rabbi Elisha ben Abuya. Okay? He is called Acher. And we will come to see at least one possible reason why he is called Acher. But let's look at these one by one. And, well, I'm not going to look yet because I want to go through the Baraita entirely. And then we'll go back to the beginning and analyze it. Amalehem Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva said to them, Kisha atem magi'in etzel avnei shayesh tahor. When you come near, you reach the pure marble stones. You come near to see the pure marble stones. Al tomru mayim mayim. Do not say water, water. Mishum shene'amar dover shkarim lo yikon l'neged enai. Because it says, a practitioner of deceit shall not dwell in my house, a speaker of lies shall not abide before my eyes. That's in the Book of Psalms. Okay? So in other words, if you say, Mayim, mayim, water, water. There's a blasphemy connected with that. It's dealt with as blasphemy. Okay, now if this isn't perplexing you, then you're not awake. This is very perplexing, of course. Okay, Benazai hetzitz vamet. Benazai peered meaning looked, and died. Alav hakatuv omer, and about him scripture says, Yakar b'nei Hashem ha'maftala chasidav. Dear in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his pious ones. Okay, so Benazai looks and dies. Dear is D-E-A-R, correct. Yakar, it's translated here in the English as difficult in the eyes of Hashem is the death of his devout ones. Yakar meaning that. I give it a more literal translation, expensive is what it means. Yakar is something in modern Hebrew that's Yakar is expensive. Okay? So it's expensive in the eyes of the Lord. It's dear in the eyes of the Lord. Dear in the eyes of the Lord. Benzoma hetzitz v'nifka. Benzoma appeared and was injured. Right, the translation here is became mentally unstable. That's according to Rashi. Nifka means that he was injured in his mind. His mind was injured. Okay? V'alava katuv omer. And about him, the scripture says, "Devash matzata echol dayecha." When you find honey, eat what is sufficient for you. Pen tizba'enu v'haketo, lest you eat too much of it and you end up throwing it up. In other words, too much of a good thing is not a good thing. All right? It's true with honey. How much more so is it true of this dangerous exposure that you have in what I'll generally call mystical experience? Okay? Acher, the other one, okay, meaning Elisha ben Abuya, kitzets banatiyot. He cut off the saplings in the orchard. Rabbi Akiva yatsa b'shalom. And Rabbi Akiva went out in peace. So four of them went in. Three of them were profoundly injured by the experience, and only one went in and came out without being hurt by what had happened. Okay? So, to begin with, on the very simplest level, obviously this is dangerous stuff. And a baraita like this is brought at this point in the text to say, okay, I told you before of the few people who had managed to have experiences of Maaseh Merkava, this mystical experience, and they were praised for it. Well, as soon as the Gemara tells you that, it immediately says, wait a minute, I must tell you something yet more important, and that is the great ones who are not only injured, but destroyed. They're destroyed mentally, they're destroyed religiously, and they're destroyed physically as a result of this kind of experience. Okay? Now, let's go back and let's look then at the text more carefully. Arba'a nichnasu babardes. Who's that? Not me. Dangerous. Somebody is responding. Okay. Arba'a nichnasu babardes. Four entered the orchard. Now, let's take that word orchard. Pardes. You know the word pardes. And to you, I would imagine, it just sounds more like a word that's actually more appropriate. Paradise. Paradise. Okay? So obviously, you see here where the English word paradise comes from. Some say it comes from the Persian. Others from the Greek. Who knows, it's probably in Persian and in Greek. It eventually makes its way into English. And of course it makes its way into English with a number of these overtones too, of something very lofty, something above and beyond everything else. The search for paradise is something that we think of as equivalent, and the way you would say it in normal Hebrew is not pardes. Normal Hebrew you would call it Gan Eden. Gan Eden. Gan Eden means paradise. And you translate Gan Eden into English, it's the Garden of Eden, but another way to translate that is paradise. Right? Because we have this sense of paradise as being the preformative, perfect place of all existence. And as a long word, I think probably the notion of Gan Eden as paradise comes after this notion of Pardes as a mystical place. As a mystical place. Eventually, paradise is conceived of also as Gan Eden, but in Hebrew, it's always called Gan Eden and not Pardes. Pardes specifically means in Hebrew something that is of a mystical nature. That kind of an orchard. Now, if you read many of the commentaries on this, you will see a later understanding of Pardes. an understanding that is basic to Jewish mysticism, really from some of the early days of Jewish mysticism, but in particular from the 12th century on, sorry, the 13th century on, where Pardes is understood to be the first letters of four different concepts. That when we study the Torah, it can be studied according to Pardes. The first method is Pshat, the simple and direct meaning of the text. The second is, that's a pay, okay? The second is Remez. Remez is a hint. The text gives you a hint of something else. And it becomes a formal textual way of studying to study Rimazim. It doesn't mean just as we would use it in English, that it means a hint. It means actually more than that, because the whole methodology of studying according to Remez. That's Pei Resh, Par. Next is Dalet, is Drash. Drash is the normal rabbinic method of study, where you take a verse and then you expound upon the verse. Okay, that's normal rabbinic method. So that's Pard, Pei Resh Dalet, and then the Samach at the end is Sod. And that is the mystery meaning. Okay, the mystical meaning of things. So if you look at Jewish mysticism, you will very frequently find the phrase of Pardes. Okay? It doesn't necessarily mean what it means here in the second century. But in a way, it's talking about the same thing, although it has four specific meanings in later thought. Okay? Pshat, Remez, Drash, and Sod. Those four methodologies of the study of the Torah text. Now, it apparently doesn't mean that in this context. It does not mean that here. And I think really that the translation of paradise is not a bad one. It's not a bad one. It's helpful that they in the art school use here orchard, because it does mean orchard. It does mean orchard. If you have stories in the Talmud, for example, about somebody who has an orchard and somebody else is guarding the orchard, that's called a pardes. It's called a pardes. Okay? So it does very clearly refer to an orchard in terms of the normal use of that terminology of orchard. But in this context, of course, it really, truly means more. Professor Gershom Scholem wrote the first great English book, which was a series of lectures that he gave about Jewish mysticism, called Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism. Any of you are interested in the subject of Jewish mysticism? To this day, there really isn't a better introduction than Scholem's great masterpiece. It became a classic, and still is a classic, Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism. Still being printed, and you can get it online if you want to get it online, but it's worth buying, because it's a masterpiece. There are lots of books that have been written since, and naturally, there's a lot that has been discovered since Scholem's time, but simply Scholem was one of these giants who was so tall that it still pays to read Scholem. Scholem points out the major trends that already in the 19th century, Pardes was understood by Jewish thinkers to probably refer to a technical form of mysticism that we know in the history of Western thought, and that was Gnosticism. Okay? Gnosticism was a whole area of religion, Gnosticism. Gnosticism ends up having an impact on Judaism. It's a form of ancient religion. It has an impact, a major, tremendous impact on the history of Christianity. GN, Gnosis. Gnosis, GNOSTICISM, Gnosticism. I just say Gnosticism, but it's actually Gnosticism, Gnosticism. The Gnostics were by and large mystics. They had a certain view of the world. And that view of the world has a tremendous impact. It's a view of the world which is generally a dualistic view of the world. By that I mean, first of all, that there is a dualism between the material creation and the spiritual creation. Okay? A dualism between the material creation and the spiritual creation. That is to say, that there is a realm of spirit and there is a realm of material things. And to the Gnostic, those do not get along with one another. And if you want to be spiritual, you need to deny the material. To the extent that you are aware, for example, of the impact of this on Christianity, Christianity is a major issue throughout the history of Christianity. Whether the body needs to be denied or not. It's an issue in St. Augustine, the early Christian fathers, and in modern Christian writings in the last 150, 200 years, it's one of the major Christian debates that's still going on in our day. And it's because of the impact of Gnosticism that in order to be spiritual, you need to deny the material. Okay? Judaism is, by the way, a very non-Gnostic religion. And that is one of its great problems as a religion. That's one of the reasons that it doesn't really appeal to people the way the other religions do. Gnostic religions are very appealing. They're very appealing. Because they really require a tremendous level of denial and asceticism. In Judaism, it turns out that asceticism is usually the exception and not the rule. In Gnostic religions, as they manifest themselves, even in the monotheistic religions, they require high levels of asceticism. And you know, the Catholic Church is the perfect example of it, where the priest has to abandon a certain level of material things and pleasures. It's all part of rising up to a higher level. The question has gone on forever, whether Paul, to what extent Paul was influenced by Gnosticism. Well, Gnosticism was in the air in the first several centuries. It was a major piece of the religion of the ancient world. It had its Greek forms. It had its Jewish forms, you'll see. And it had its eventually Christian forms. And then each of the religions has got to say, yes, but, because it's in a way a very enticing way of finding religious experience. By the way, anyone who want to read something that was just written this week on the subject, and this is not ancient stuff. I don't know how many of you read in the internet Mosaic. Mosaic, M-O-S-A-I-C, Mosaic. Mosaic is a wonderful weekly, it's a daily intellectual journal, but they have usually a major article each month. And the January article in Mosaic is on the anti-Semitism of Richard Wagner. And the fellow who wrote an article is a musicologist. It's a brilliant article. I don't know how much he knows about Gnosticism, but essentially it's an article about Gnosticism. And what it is an analysis of the perpetual engagement of Wagner's music. Why it is that Wagner is such a powerful composer, and what he was trying to do as a result of his music, which was essentially to bring people totally out of the material existence and into a totally spiritual existence. And one of the reasons that he hated Judaism, because Judaism acknowledged the value of the material. Judaism is a religion in the material. And for Wagner, that was the essence of evil. Because the material world is evil. Only the spiritual world is redeeming, never the material world. Okay, all this is not this. Okay, even this week, it's out there. It's out there. A magnificent article this fellow wrote. So Scholem says that the term pardes, really is a way of talking about Gnosticism. And let's see if I have the source. The source there was a German, Manuel Joel, in the 19th century, in 1880, wrote a book called Blicke in Religionsgeschichte, where he theorizes that pardes is a Talmudic metaphor for Gnosticism. How is it a Talmudic metaphor for Gnosticism? Because in paradise, in the Bible, which is where? Gan Eden, in the Garden of Eden. What is the central thing in the Garden of Eden that is a challenge? It is a tree of knowledge. And what is gnosis? Knowledge. Alright? Gnosis is secret knowledge. And therefore, pardes is a metaphor, he says, for gnosis, which is knowledge, secret knowledge, because of the tree of knowledge in paradise. A very magnificent idea. Magnificent idea. Okay? But that's what pardes is referring to. Okay? So whether he's right that pardes is a metaphor for Gnosticism, you know, and it goes back to the story of the Garden of Eden. Well, it doesn't matter, because I think there's no doubt about the fact that it is a metaphor. It nonetheless is talking about Gnosticism. And what the rabbis are experiencing here is different types of Gnostic experiences. Now, together with gnosis, gnosis involves a mystical secret knowledge of truth. There is this bifurcation of the material and the spiritual. And one of the results of that is that in Gnosticism, there's not only a dualism of the creation, but there is a dualism of the creator. Creator. Why? Because the Gnostic reasoned as follows. That the good gods, the perfect gods, would never create anything that is less than perfect. And therefore, the world which is imperfect and which is missing the spiritual must have been created not by the good God, but by an alternate God. Okay? And therefore, basic to most Gnosticism is the notion that there are not only two realms in the physical world, but two realms in the divine world. There is a good God and a bad God. Okay?
The Demiurge.
A Demiurge is the same thing. The Demiurge, the Demiurgos in Greek, which you have in Plato. Plato's notion of the demiurge. In Plato, there is a good God who is the creator of the perfection, of perfection. And he then delegates the dirty work of the creating of the world to the demiurgos, okay? To the secondary gods, okay? Because he wouldn't do it himself. He wouldn't do it himself. He is a perfect God. But there's got to be them too, okay? So you need to keep that in mind also, because when we are reading about the dangers of these things, in a way they are very attractive dangers, and what you have here is the logical endpoint of these experiential dangers, okay? It is, I said, even the danger in Wagner's music, according to this interpretation of Wagner, that the whole purpose of music is to free us from our material existence and to bring us into redemption. And the whole notion of redemption is entirely spiritual and not at all physical. Right? The idea that you could have redemption within humanity, for example, redemption, as Jews would say, redemption within the plane of history, is an abhorrent idea to the Gnostic mentality. You cannot have any redemption within the plane of history because it's impossible. Redemption requires a bursting energy that overcomes everything else. One of the most fascinating lecture I ever heard on Gnosticism was given by Yochanan Mass. You remember Professor Yochanan Mass. Yochanan Mass is a genius, a professor of Bible in the seminary. And he gave a lecture on Gnosticism when we were students. I was a student of Mass in 68, 69. Now some of you in this room will remember 1968 and 69, what the world was like, what the Columbia campus was like in 1968 and 69. It was the world of SDS, the byword of creativity was burn the building down, burn the building down. Right? Now there are all kinds of ways to improve the world. This way of improving the world required first that you burn the building down. Not that you make a better building. Not that you figure out who was better, that you make better people in the building. Why? Because it was, most cases, this lecture. Because it's essentially a Gnostic way of bringing the redemption, which is in an explosion. The only way to make things better is to explode the world. Explode it. Because the world is material, and that which is material is no good, and you need a tremendous chord of music. And then everybody is totally demolished. And they leave the theater just... they don't know what happened to them. They've been hit so hard. Okay, this is Gnosticism. I give you this background to sort of bring alive in our experience, in our terminology, what I think are some of the things that are going on. So, Hades Padis. Hades is, in all likelihood, Gnosticism, Gnostic experience. And we'll see a little bit more of that shortly, okay? Any questions so far?
The way you presented Gnosticism is as a, let's say, the concept of the dualism between spiritual and material, is proof that it comes from, I'm not a scholar, but from Gnosticism, because within any group, there's always some issue about that, even in Jewish religion. We may sit down Shabbos at the table, and that's, at least to us, I think, most people, this is the important part of Shabbat. Everything is over with, the issue appears in this. But when it comes to, say, Yom Kippur, where we have to be especially spiritual, we have to
deny the material.
To give up everything.
Correct.
Anything, because denial makes you more sensitive to this person.
No, you're right. This is, in a way, this is a religious perspective that you will find all over the world. It's all over the world in different religions. It has a particular form in the Hellenistic world, in the Greek world, which comes to be known as Gnosis. Okay? It has a tremendous impact on Western civilization, largely because of its impact on Christianity, which becomes the religion of Western civilization in time. I'm not saying that it's limited. I had a story to tell you. That story, it's a story about your story. It's a story about your story, about Shabbos. Okay? It's just to give you an example of this. Heschel told us that we used to have a seminar on Mondays. And sometimes the seminary would run, it was called the Institute of Religious and Social Studies, which Dr. Finkelstein had developed, and it was developed during the Roosevelt administration, and it was a major effort to bring Judaism into the marketplace of ideas. So, when Heschel came on board, he was finally came to the seminary in February of 1947-48. He came to the United States. He was brought to the United States by Hebrew College. He had gone from Warsaw to London, Hebrew Union College hired him to Cincinnati. So he went to Cincinnati, and then, see, the late 40s or the very early 50s, maybe it was 1950, that he was hired by the seminary. So he didn't go to the seminary first. So he then became one of the principal people of Dr. Finkelstein's Institute of Religious and Social Studies, which brought together people from different religions. Leaders in American religion then were mostly Protestant leaders, but Finkelstein had this broader view of bringing together all the religions, Buddhism and Hinduism among them. So I had a meeting one weekend, and I remember Heschel comes in on Monday, and he says, "Boys," he always called us boys. Women, of course, and we were not men, we were boys. He says, "Boys, I must tell you, that happened to me. I gave a lecture on Shabbos, and I gave a lecture on Shabbos, and there was a Hindu, and there was a Buddhist, and they're listening to me talk about Shabbos, and they love it." He says, "They listen to Shabbos, and Shabbos is everything that's wonderful. It's spiritual. It's got everything in life. It is fantastic. And I know I've got them." He says, "But afterwards, the Hindu comes over to me, and he says to me, 'Rabbi Heschel, there's one thing I do not understand about your Shabbos.'" He says, "Yes, tell me, how can I help you?" He says, "The Hindu says to me, he says, I do not, it's so spiritual. How can you eat anything?" As a Hindu, would have a fast. If you're going to have a spiritual time, you fast. And Shabbos, you have to eat. So he tried to put it in the two in contrast. Shabbos and the Hindu Shabbos. The thought of eating in a moment of spiritual exaltation It's profane. It's completely profane. But it's completely Jewish. And that's the nature of this religion compared to that one. You're right, we have a few very limited ascetic pieces to Judaism. Strangely, for whatever reason, they're highly limited. Highly limited.
When you say when Moses had to God to receive the Torah, had to isolate himself from
Correct.
In order to bring himself.
Yeah. That's right. So you got it there. You got it. And when the people are about to receive a revelation, the men have to separate from the women. They cannot have any sexual relations. Okay? Later Judaism, we think the opposite. The sexual relations are a part of the holiness of marriage, and that's a vehicle of holiness within the context of marriage.
On Shabbos.
That's correct. Sexual relations on Shabbos. That's the right way to do it. That's it. Okay, so now we've seen a little bit about what Pardes is. We've seen that the four went into Pardes, and they were Ben Azai, Ben Zoma. Same Ben Zoma.
It really isn't a Pardes. Isn't really a place. It's an idea, isn't it?
Well, it's not a physical place.
I mean, they began this.
It's a state of mind. Once you enter the world of speculation, it is a place in which the mind lodges itself. So I'm a little bit unsure about whether to use the word place or not. Certainly not a physical place. Absolutely not a physical place. Not a physical place at all. If it is a place, it is a place of spiritual reality entirely.
So it reminds me of all that you've been talking about is what we've all become too familiar with, which is suicide bombers' concepts of why they're willing to do a suicide bomb as long as they're living.
Mm-hmm.
Because they believe that they're going to a place which is not a place, a physical place, but it is a place of great spiritual depth and satisfaction and holiness. And the more you speak, I don't know about anyone else, but the more you speak, that's flooding my mind.
Along those lines.
How it was used for another place.
It's important to keep that in mind because Sholem in the later book, in his book on symbols and Jewish mysticism, writes about the danger of mysticism, And implicit in all of this are certain obvious dangers, which you've just articulated. If you have access to an experience that is absolutely beyond all other experiences, and you can actually get there, then there is at least a possibility that that experience can substitute for everything else. It can become the only motivating source in your life. If you start with a religion like Judaism, for example, that's a religion of mitzvot, the danger is that you can have experience which tells you not to observe the mitzvot. Even that could happen. Okay? There are many possibilities here, and implicit in this is potential danger. Okay? Stands the reason. Yes?
So, if we consider this to be the kind of engagement in this mystical study, didn't we just learn that only one can do it, so aren't there four of them doing it together? Is that after?
That's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that, because I don't know that it means they did it together. The way it's articulated here in the Baraita, it appears as if this is something they're doing together. But then that's not mean that. It could be that this is just a literary form of telling us that in that world where people did engage, and there were four who engaged in this kind of study and experience, there were four different reactions. Okay? They were not necessarily, they were, some of them were contemporaries. They were not exact contemporaries. They were sort of contemporaries, some of them. That's my answer. Okay?
But the outcome indicates that they did study on their own, and that's why there's four different outcomes.
Correct. That's also possible. And there were four different people.
Four different perspectives.
Absolutely. Okay? Okay. Now, Amar Lahem Rabbi Akiva, before they entered, Rabbi Akiva said to them, Kisha'atem magi'im etzel avnei shayish tahor, al tomru mayim mayim. When you reach near the pure marble stones, do not say, water, water. Okay? Do not say, water, water. Mishum she'ne'amar, because it is said, dover shkarim lo yikon l'neged einai, a speaker of lies shall not abide before my eyes. Well, this is weird. Okay? Rabbi Akiva says, now this would make us think that they are together. They are together. It's not necessarily true. It could be that Rabbi Akiva, in his teaching over a period of time, warn people who are engaging in this kind of experiential religion the following. When you come to the stones of pure marble, don't say water, water. God knows what that is, okay? That's really weird stuff. It's, of course, symbolic language. Symbolic language. And the truth is that today we know what he's referring to. For a long time, we didn't know what was being referred to. But we have recovered the Hechalot texts. We've recovered these Hechalot texts. And so we know what's being said here. I'm going to read it to you. First, this is Hechalot Zutarte. Hechalot Zutarte is one of the classic Hechalot texts. There are two, both of them called Hechalot. Genechalot is the inner realms of the temple. Okay, these are mystical texts. There's Hechalot Zutarti, which means the small. Zutar in Aramaic is small. And there's Hechalot Rabati, which is the big one. Okay? That mi she'eino ra'ui lir'ot melech biyofyo. The one who is not worthy of seeing the king in his beauty. Okay? Beauty. Yokyo. His beauty. Now, this is symbolic language. This is all metaphors. This is God. In other words, the one who is not worthy of having a revelation of the divine presence. That's the way they say it here in the Hechalot Zutarte. Notnin belibo. The kevam she'omrim lo hikanes, they allow his mind, libo his mind or his heart, they allow it to go far. They allow his mind to take him to this place. And they say to him, hikanes, go in. In other words, there's a temptation here. A person is not worthy of having this level of religious experience. But his yetzer, his evil desire, right, understood here as the thing itself, the temptation of this experience, says to him, hikanes, come in. He shouldn't be going in, but it says, come in. Haya nichnas, this person goes in. Right? He shouldn't have done it. Miyad sochtim oto. They immediately squeeze him. Umashlichin oto letoch rigion gachalim. And they cast him into a region of hot coals. Okay? In other words, he shouldn't have been there in the first place. He's tempted to go in. As soon as he enters, they tell him, come on in. All I can say to you is that we don't know that that's the case. I mean, you don't have any literature about the consumption of anything in particular, let's say mushrooms, as you have in South American mysticism, for example, opiates, or something like that. We have no records of anything like that in any of this literature. It all has to do with states of meditative concentration. And that is, remember, the power of the Merkava, of the imagery, that's biblical imagery. And then, of course, you'll see we'll get, maybe tonight, we'll get to some of the imagery that we read about last time, which was in Maaseh Bereishit, which was of the seven heavens. There's a certain astronomy that's behind this. It's a sense of the universe and of rising to a higher spiritual reality within the known universe itself. Yeah?
Some Ezekiel visions are highly suspect.
What do you mean they're highly suspect?
In terms of what he may have nothing
well,
experiencing.
Maybe. Keep in mind that when it came time to produce the canon, there was some question about the book of Ezekiel. Because of some of these things, you can see the sensitivity of the rabbis producing the canon, which was the same, this is the same rabbis that wrote this Mishnah of Ein Dorshin. So they are worried about these things, which is not to say they don't indulge, but they're also worried about them. Okay? Okay, so here you saw the first guy. Upatach Hechal Hashishi. And he opened the sixth Hechal. Sixth Hechal. If you remember last year, we read about seven heavens. There were seven heavens. And we talked about the imagery. That imagery of seven heavens has come into our Western mythology. We talk about being in seven heavens. Okay?
Well,
that may induce in some seventh heaven. Okay? So, all of that is a notion of when you're in seventh heaven, you're where? You're in paradise. Okay? You're in paradise. So, here, the level below the highest is Aichal HaShishi, the sixth temple, as it were, the sixth temple. Hayam Yireh Kemishu Tordin Bo Mea Elef Alafim Ribei Rivavot Galei Mayim. Like the person who enters into that place, it appears to him as if he's being buffeted. That's how I translated Tordin, as if he's being buffeted by Mea Elef Alafim, 100,000 thousands, Ribei Rivavot, tens of thousands of waves of water. Now we're beginning to get to water imagery. Okay? Right? He's being buffeted by these tremendous, powerful waves of water. Okay? The Ein Bo Afilu Tefach Achat Shel Mayim Elame Avir Ziv, and he doesn't even have tefach achad shalmayim. And the truth is that there isn't even one hand's breadth of water. Okay? So here you see the imagery of Rabbi Akiva. Okay? He thinks that he's being buffeted by tremendous waves of water, and there isn't even a hand's breadth of water. Ela me avir ziv avnei shayish. Rather, it is the air of the splendor of the rocks of marble, okay? The rocks of marble, tahor, the pure rocks of marble, shahayu slulot b'hechal, shahayu slulot b'hechal, which paved that temple, okay? So in other words, it's a water image which in effect really is a way of expressing the power of the light on the mind of the person who has arrived at that level of mystical experience. Shaya ziv marehem noram mimayim. The splendor of their vision was more awesome than water. Okay? Bahalo hamishartim omdim kenegdo. And in fact, the servants were standing next to him. The im amar hamayim halalu mativan. And if he were to say, these waters, what is their nature? That's where Rabbi Akiva was saying. Miyad rasim acharav biskila. They immediately rush after him biskila, to stone him. V'omrim reka mimasav. You are empty in your deeds. You're not worthy to be here. Okay? Ein ata tzofeh be'enecha. You cannot see with your eyes. Shema zira'am mizir'am shel menashke egel ata. Perhaps you are of the seed of those who kiss the golden calf. Alright? Yeah, the imagery here is powerful. Ve'ein ata ra'ui lir'ot melech per yofyo. And you are not worthy to see the king in his beautiful glory. Okay? So that's from Hechalot Zutarte. And that is what Rabbi Akiva is referring to when he makes his cryptic statement. Okay? So in other words, if you mention the water, you're not worthy to be here. You're not worthy. You shouldn't be there. Well, either that or he studied the literature. He's certainly warning them. He's certainly, because that's exactly his purpose here, is to warn them. Purpose is to warn them. But of course, the nature of the thing is that even if you're warned, you're tempted into this, if you're not worthy of it, you will be decimated in one form or another by it. Okay? That's why you're better off not even getting near it. It's so dangerous.
Can you specify where the writing comes from?
No. This source that I have, it is the these manuscripts that are called Hechalot Zutarte and Hechalot Rabati. These are mystical manuscripts of the rabbinic period, which are spoken of as the writings of Hechalot mysticism. Hechalot mysticism.
So when were they uncovered?
Well, they were known. The truth is that they've been known since the early Middle Ages. We had traditions of them in Rabbi Chai Gaon, for example. In the Gaonic period, the Gaonim will include references to these texts, so that they were known throughout the history of Jewish mysticism in the, we're talking about the 10th century, 9th and 10th centuries here, so that there is a continuity here of all of this. The actual manuscripts, I don't know exactly when they were recovered, I believe 19th century. I believe it's 19th century.
Because the imagery of water is so profoundly coming out of Mesopotamia, where every beseechment to the gods is water. And it's repetitive. Their literature is all repetitive. So the in the Epic of Gilgamesh, even lines, they're not even parallelisms. There's repetition. So it's extraordinary in the sense of the vessel and the overflowing. We can show imagery that we have going back to 2000 millennium, which is exactly that.
Keep in mind also that the Bible takes off on that same imagery, because the Bible begins with a vision of water. That's how the Bible begins. The story of the creation is a story of unseparated water. And we'll get to this here in the text. Reference is going to be made to this notion in the Talmud you'll see that it's potentially very problematic, but it's crucial. Water imagery is imagery that is very basic to this kind of religious experience, although usually it's light imagery. I mean, here you can see a conflict between light and water imagery, I think, because he is warning them against thinking that the water is water when the water really is light. The power is the power of light. So there I think you have a conflict of images and metaphors.
Is a the way it's presented, the way you presented it, it's a warning. His problem is he's unworthy because he is not well enough to perform if he hasn't studied. So by the time he reaches the sixth level, he can't distinguish. He can't distinguish reality from the fantasies that he's experiencing. So he has no way of putting it in context. He thinks this feeling he has is actually water. Yeah. And so he should go back home, study a little more before you come back, and you'll be able to realize, didn't we learn last year that at this level, or one of these levels, in the Shamayim, is where the rain clouds were stored?
Mm-hmm. Correct. I don't remember exactly which one it was. Yeah. I think it was lower down.
Okay, so it was lower down. But you have to be able to
distinguish
in context, which is not easy to do here. But
it's not easy to do also once you, because you're presupposing that you need to be able to have a consciousness above and beyond what you are experiencing. And I think essential to mystic experience is the notion of a loss of consciousness. In fact, you are what you are.
But you couldn't write it down and you couldn't discuss it unless you had consciousness.
Maybe you can't write it down. Maybe you can. I don't know whether you can tell the tale. That's a basic problem to this. Mysticism is whether you can talk about it, and if you can, how you can talk about it.
Basic problem. To Freud, because he can interpret these dreams, you might say.
Well, it's a good point that here you see sort of the background of this notion of the unconscious. That, you know, it's got to be a Jewish guy who comes up with that kind of thing, eventually, as a major world-shaking idea. But you see that these ideas of a level of consciousness are very old ideas.
Well, you know, when you're a child, what you experience in your dreams is as real as what you experience when you're awake.
Not only when you're a child. I said, not only when you're a child. Or to take the notion of art. I mean, what was Andy Warhol doing? Tell me. I always wonder, what was Andy Warhol doing? Okay.
You mean in general, in terms of, you know, art?
Oh, yeah, what was happening with those canvases? Okay.
Which one?
Right. Well, any of them. I mean, is there a notion of the unconscious application of the oils to the canvas?
No, he was a little more concrete. He was really taking very concrete things, and he called it a factory. So he was, instead of, you know, like the abstract expressionist, trying to get this unconscious and things flowing.
In an abstract expression.
Yes. They were really going from the unconscious and some chance and some accident, because it somehow had a closer connection to the unconscious, what was going on while you're dreaming. And he was really taking it from the very concrete world, from things around us, and using them as symbols, and getting to the point where there was a very clear outline. Start out that way, but it got very crisp and clear, and was a kind of a merging of advertising and popular imagery and high art in a very interesting way, kind of seeing what images mean in the culture.
How about then Salvatore Dali?
Well, better example? Surrealism. He's
surrealism, perhaps.
Dreams made visible.
Uh-huh.
Theological made visible.
I think
people who talk about mystical experience, they say people who talk about mystical experience talk what they're transported during this experience, and they lose awareness of consciousness, which is different than unconscious acting or awareness or behavior, and it's only after the fact that when you come back into
put
the world and
back
into your body,
correct,
that you can
record
it.
That's
when
right.
It gets recorded.
I think that exactly. There's a sort of the down life after
right.
When you come down.
Back. You come down.
Yeah. Okay. Let's just see. One more minute. Let's just get to the see if there's anything we now understand. Rabbi Akiva's imagery. Ben Azai hitzitz v'met. Right. Ben Azai looks and is killed by it. Ben Zoma looks and becomes mentally undone by it. And Acher kitzetz b'netiyot. Acher, Rabbi Elisha ben Abuya, kitzetz b'netiyot. The Talmud's imagery is very beautiful here because he cuts off the shoots. Shoots meaning what is in the pardes. In a pardes, in an orchard, you have little things growing, and eventually they turn into trees, right? Full-blown mystical trees. But the netiyot are what you've planted, what is the basis of everything. And if you cut off the basis of it, that in a way is saying that you're taking the mystical experience and you are using it to undo the roots, the basic roots, which are the roots of this faith. Okay, so the Talmud uses the imagery of the pardes and uses it in order to indicate the undoing of faith.
Could it also mean the corruption of young people who might be in the faith, that they're saplings?
Well, we'll see.
Potential.
Could that's interesting. Could be. That's an interesting thought. Let's keep that in mind as we see more description of Acher and some of the things that he does and some of the things that he says. To be continued next week.
Thank you.
A week ago.
Very narrow to all the other intro in the movie.